Hey everyone, you're tuning in to Deeper Grooves, Musicians on Music, hosted by Cliff Beach and sponsored by California Soul Music Record Label. Today I have the pleasure of speaking with a Berklee College of Music buddy of mine, Kendrick Scott, with his new album, A Wall Becomes a Bridge, out now on Blue Note Records. He's played with a who's who's list of jazz, including Robert Glasper, Liz Wright, Terrence Blanchard, and so many more. Please help me welcome Kendrick.
Hello, Kendrick.
Yes, how you doing?
I'm good, how are you?
I'm hanging in there.
That's good, man. That's the best that we could do during these times, for sure. Very excited to talk to you today. I've been following your stuff for a while, seeing you in documentaries and all kinds of stuff, and just love that you're doing so well and getting new content out there. And I listened to your latest album, and it's really, really great. I mean, it just sonically and musicality of it is just top notch.
Thank you so much, man. I appreciate that.
So I wanted to chat about it. When you were creating this last album, A Wall Becomes a Bridge, what was your process for making this great jazz album?
Well, I mean, it's funny because the process kind of stemmed from insecurity. You know, it's one of those things where I guess it's one of those things about being an artist sometimes where everything you make, you're kind of like, I don't know if this is good or not. And then other people, you know, from outside, they're like, no, it's actually cool, man, this is cool. And, you know, I have that no, go in my head all the time. And sometimes it gets the best of me, to be honest with you. So, as I was writing and things, working on things, you know, I'm kind of like, I don't know if I like this. And so it's great to have good friends who are catalysts in your life. And Derek Hodge was that catalyst for me. He said, you know what? This is actually really cool. And what we should do is really make that the concept of the record, dealing with insecurities and things like that, and seeing how we can use them as springboards for our true voices to come out, you know? So that was the beginnings of the concept of the record. And we used that to expand upon, you know, songs that I've been creating and everything, and coming to them with that mindset and showing how the wall, which is insecurity, and it stands for a lot of different other things as well, how that wall can become a bridge. You know, you take that that fear and turn it into hope, and you turn it into some beauty, you know. So that was the thing we were looking at as we were making the music. We tried to make the music embody what the feeling of the record was.
I like that. I like that concept a lot. And I think a lot of people can relate to it, because I think no matter what level of artistry you have, and you've done in your illustrious career so many amazing things that we'll talk about, I don't think you ever lose fully insecurity or fear. You just have to create in spite of that and push past those feelings, because I think every artist has levels of insecurity and doubt. And I think, you know, you use it as a catalyst, as you said, to make something. You can kind of hear it in the music and in the vibe. It's like an overcoming record.
Yeah, well, I appreciate that, man. Yeah, it's definitely that way. And you know, the way we created the record was actually in reverse. So if you actually check out the names of and the vibe of the record, instead of coming from, you know, this wall that we break down and it becomes a bridge, it starts from the other way around. It starts from the bridge and it goes back to the wall. So, you know, we wanted to talk about how perspective can change everything. And if we, like, especially in the times we're in right now, if we look at everything that's going on right now from a different perspective, we might act differently, I think. Once we gain perspective on things, it brings us out of, like, you know, like Derek telling me, it's like, no, your music is okay, let's go for it. You know, that changed my whole perspective on how I felt about my own music, you know. And I feel like the more and more we talk as human beings and come together, we can gain new perspective on what's going on with this coronavirus and what's going on in our country here, you know. It's revealing a whole lot of things, you know, and those, you know, for me, the main thing it's revealing is how much we need each other, period. You know, it took us quarantining and being, you know, in our place by ourselves for us to realize how much we need each other and how dependent we are on one another. And so this record is about that as well, you know, that wall becoming a bridge as well. And who would have known that this would have happened, you know?
No, I agree. And I think, you know, a lot of people that are going through this time, we're all going through it together. A lot of times it can feel like it's the worst thing that ever happened to you. But at the same time, perspective allows you to zoom out. And so when you zoom out, you think about, you know, 10 years ago, the problems that you had then, you don't remember. And if you fast forward 10 years from now, this will be much, much, much further back. And so I think it is beautiful to be able to think about it from the perspective of being at the bridge, which is where you want to be, and then going backwards to the wall to see that not where you start is where you have to necessarily end up. So I think that's amazing. So talking about kind of your career journey so far, you've made great records and you've played with some amazing heavy hitters in jazz, Terrence Blanchard, Gretchen Parlato, Robert Glasper, who you've done a few different things with, the Jazz Crusaders, guitarist Pat Metheny, Diane Reeves and Liz Wright, and so many more. Do you have a memorable experience or the most memorable experience from working with these people?
Well, I always say my greatest experiences were my times with Terrence Blanchard. I stayed with Terrence Blanchard for 11 years, and I grew so much from being around Terrence to watching his leadership and how he took on the flag of Art Blakey. I feel like Art Blakey was a man who had people in his band, but he was training them to be leaders. And I feel like Terrence was doing the same with us in the way he gave us and afforded us so many opportunities to be leaders in his band, orally, you know, through our playing and otherwise through our writing. And if you look at it now, you look at Aaron Parks, you look at Lionel Lewicke, you look at Ed Simon and, you know, Derek Hodge, so many of the cats that were in his bands are now like established band leaders. And that is a testament to him. And I learned so much from him. And, you know, one thing that he taught me, he said, if God ever lays a question on your mind and you look around and you don't see the answer, he said, that question is for you to answer. And I had to sit and think about that for a while. And, you know, I was thinking like, where's the drummer that does this and does this and does this? And I looked around and I didn't see that person. And so I get up every day trying to answer that question, you know, and I think that was a really great time for me. And then that's like the top for me, you know, but the very, very, very tip top was being with Herbie Hancock. And I felt that all of the things that Terrence was telling me was realized in this man. Herbie's the one that taught me that really, really taught me that music isn't about music. And, you know, here I am being around Herbie Hancock every day for, you know, 3 months. We're on tour, we're on the bus. And, you know, I'm looking for the technicalities of, wow, it's Herbie Hancock. So he plays piano and he does all this stuff and he does these crazy things on musically and everything. And I realized it's not even about any of that. It's about how we were chanting every day before the show. You know what I mean? And you know, he's a practicing Buddhist. So I sat with him and I chanted with him, you know. And after we chanted, there was a vibration. And he continued that vibration on the stage. And he continued that vibration after we played. He continued that vibration throughout the day as we talked to people, as we traveled, as everything. And the more I learned about music, the more I realized that music isn't about music, it's about life. And the more life you live, the more you have to play. You know, it's like you can't really pour from an empty cup. And so someone like Herbie and Terrence and my heroes, all of these great musicians and great people are pouring from full cups, you know, they're constantly filling their cups back, you know. So that's been a great inspiration for me.
Yeah, very well said by both of them. And I've heard that about Herbie. We've had drummer Mike Clark on who worked with him with the Headhunters. And he said, yeah, he got him into Buddhism and they were chanting all the time. And he just, he transcends the doing part of music and is more concerned with the being. It's not what you do, it's who you are. And so I think that's amazing that you had that experience. And I think, you know, he's just like a walking source of energy and light and information at the same time.
For sure.
So when you were with Terrence Blanchard, you also toured extensively with the Monterey Jazz Festival's 50th anniversary. You did a 22-state tour, and this band had leaders of the present and past. So Terrence Blanchard was in there, James Moody, Benny Green, Derek Hodge, Nina Freelon, who I love. What was it like being in such an all-star studded jazz group?
Well, that was one of the best times as well. You know, for it was crazy because at the time, I was the mirror image of James Moody. He was 82 and I was 28. So every time I would get up and, you know, he was such an important man throughout the history of this music. And, you know, I would get up and come downstairs. Again, music isn't about music, it's about life. And Moody was the first person down. So if they said, yo, you know, let's meet at 9 a.m., Moody was waiting at 6, you know, and you'd be like, why is he doing it? Why is he so early? You know, anytime you come down, you think you're going to be first, he is already there. And when I got on the stage with him, I realized that's the level of intensity he takes with the music. He's always prepared. He's always willing and open and open-minded. And I learned so much from him in his professionalism and his love for music and for life. And being around him was like the greatest. And Nina Freelon was amazing. And of course, Terrence is amazing, Benny Green. I took something from everybody on their tour and my brother, Derek Hodge. You know, we've been coming up together for so long. But Moody really left a huge mark on me going he has that thing that's very hard to do, to capture our audience with wit, make them laugh, make them cry, and make them think. You know what I mean? He has all of that stuff. And he could do it with the microphone talking, or he could do it with his horn. And always, still to this day, I'm so blessed that I got to be around him.
Yeah, that truly is a blessing. And that's not even the pinnacle of kind of supergroups that you've done. I saw you also in the latest Blue Note documentary series, movie. You were a member of the Blue Note Records 75th anniversary all-star band. And that had Ambrose, Robert Glasper, and your brother Derek Hodge with a ton of other musicians. And whenever I see you on the screen, I'm like, I know that guy. I've seen that guy. And so how did you come to be a part of the Blue Note family? And how does that allow you to get into another powerhouse group?
Well, yeah, I mean, my relationship with Blue Note is kind of longstanding. Wow, I didn't even think about it. Well, I mean, that's not that long, but when I first started with Terrence, you know, my first record with Terrence was 2004, I think. I think it was Flow, but Flow was on Blue Note. And before then, I had even got to, well, actually, wow, I didn't even think about it. Check that out. Well, I met Bruce Lundvall in 1999. The first time I traveled with my drum set, I got the Blue Note scholarship to attend the Skidmore Jazz Institute up in Saratoga Springs, New York. And they brought me up, and I remember having my drums with me on the plane. I thought it was the coolest thing ever to be traveling and, you know, everything. And there I was, and I showed up, and I got the Blue Note scholarship, and I met Bruce Lundvall when I was 19. So that was my first time, you know, meeting Bruce and meeting somebody from Blue Note. And so that was a beautiful thing to think this was the man that was over the company that pretty much, you know, has encapsulated the shape of jazz before and to this day, you know, to that day and now continuing on. So that is how I met Bruce. And then actually later that year, wow, all this stuff, I haven't really contemplated all this in a while, but later that year I met Terrence in a more formal way as I was going to college, because Eric Harlan was in his band and me and Eric Harlan went to the same high school. at different times. He graduated right before me. I met Terrence through Eric, and then I got in the Betty Carter Jazz Ahead program, and Terrence heard me play. Me and Aaron Parks were in that program together, and Marcus Strickland and a whole bunch of other cats. So Terrence heard me play anyway. And then some years later, Eric was moving on to do bigger and better things, as he does all the time. And he said, you know, Terrence, you should hire Kendrick. And Terrence hired me. And so that just leads me to playing on Terrence's first record, Flow. And that was a great experience because Herbie was the producer of that record. That started my relationship with Blue Note, played on a few records for Blue Note. And then as Don Was was taking over, the great Don Was, he started getting new artists. And this is where I was saying that Terrence trains up leaders. You know, at the time, they had signed Aaron Parks out of the band and Lionel Lewicke out of the band. Wow, I can't remember if I got signed before Derek or Derek got signed before me. But anyway, all four of us got signed to Blue Note. And Rob got signed some years before all of us. Rob got signed. And so, I don't know, it's just a family affair. When I look back and I see, you know, people like Lee Morgan, Freddie Hubbard, and Art Blakey, and Higgins, and like all these people, when you look around, man, you see those names, they reoccur through most of the discography of what Blue Note is. And, you know, I felt like I was in the family of musicians, and I feel like I came to the attention of Don, you know, musically as we were playing some shows as that group. Actually, our manager, we had the same manager, me, Robert, Christian Scott, and Derek Hodge. We all have the same manager. So we actually put a band together, and it wasn't with Christian, it was with Ambrose. And of course, Ambrose had been signed, you know. And so we put a group together and played, and we were like, man, we should do more with this. And so that was the beginning of that band. And then we were blessed to have Herbie and Wayne sit in with us on the recording. So, I mean, it was such a beautiful blessing. And, you know, it was a cool snapshot of that day. We just came in for that day and just kind of hit. I guess it was 2 days. Two days. I can't remember how many days it was, but I always say that was just a Polaroid snapshot of just, you know, all of us together and getting to hang with the masters and play for a minute.
Yeah, and I really like that the masters are willing to take on younger cats, not just to add new energy and new blood, but really, as you said, to train up leaders. And I think it's important for people to understand that leaders are not born. They really are trained. They really are created. It's something through a process. I don't think it's necessarily something that can just happen. You really have to put in the time and the effort, and having those types of masters, I mean, who are better teachers than those? So I want to talk a little bit about your origin story. I know that you're originally from Houston, Texas. You grew up playing in church. You went to Performing Arts High School. You actually won the Clifford Brown Stan Getz Fellowship that was given by the International Association for Jazz Education and National Foundation for the Advancement of the Arts. You received a scholarship also to attend the famed Berklee College of Music in the late 90s, early 2000s. What is your origin story and how did you get into music?
Well, yeah, like you were saying, I come from a family of musicians. My mom plays piano. So at church, my mom would be playing this piano, conducting the choir. My brother played organ. And my father was in sound reinforcement. So that was, you know, my life, being in church many days a week. And pretty much after every service or after anything, I would go up to the drummer and tap him on the shoulder and say, you know what, can I play the drums? You know, it was a line of kids always wanting to play the drums. And, you know, my interest just kept growing and growing. And it's funny that it's Halloween last night, because I took my jack-o'-lantern from Halloween, my little plastic jack-o'-lantern, and I made that my snare drum. In my closet, underneath my clothes, I took my shoeboxes and made those toms. And I got really in trouble for this, but I took my mom's records and I made those cymbals. And then I took what were those things? Yeah, I took the hangers, you know, the pant hangers, you know how they have that cardboard You can just take it loose and to use those drumsticks, right? And so that's how I created my drum set at home in the closet. And my mom caught me one day in there. Of course, I got in trouble for the records, but she said, you know what? I guess he does have an interest to play. She bought me a drum pad. And then a couple of years later, she bought me a drum set. And I was just enthralled with playing drum set. I loved it. After that, I went to middle school, was really enthralled with playing marching band. That was the thing. I wanted to do that. You know, in Texas, marching band and football is huge. So I wanted to do that. But then my mom said, you know, on my way to high school, she said, well, you know, there aren't that many marching bands out there. You know, DCI and all of that, that's not a living. You know, you might be able to go to New Orleans playing the, you know, in a band like that, but really I want you to think bigger. And so she made me audition for the high school for the performing and visual arts. And I got in, and that's where I met Walter Smith and Glasper and Beyonce and like all these people who are in my high school who are just amazing at what they did. And so I always tell people that being around people at that age like that was making the extraordinary ordinary. And I feel like when you know, my mom was always saying, be sure you're around people that are influencing you in good ways. And so I felt that was a great thing for me to get to go to that high school, to be under Bob Morgan's tutelage and to learn from my peers, to really get pushed by my peers. And also to see the lineage of cats that have come out of Houston, you know, Eric Harlan leaving right as I was coming in and seeing Chris Dave and Sebastian Whitaker and Mark Simmons, you know, so many of the cats were influential in my time. So, and then after I left HSPVA and went on to Berklee College of Music, got up there and met so many great musicians. But it's funny because I went up there with Walter Smith and Mark Kelly, who was the bass player for the Roots now. You know, we all went up there together, and like the other crew went to New York, Glasper and Moreno, all those guys, they ended up in New York straight away. And of course, I wanted to go to New York straight away. But my mom said, you know what, you should maybe study music education, you know, and check that out. So I went to Berklee. Yeah, I met so many great people, great musicians. Esperanza was there, Christian Scott, Jeremy Pelt, so many great musicians. John Mayer, it was incredible. Incredible time up there at Berklee. And as it's time to leave Berklee, I'm getting calls from Joe Sample. And I said, wow, what is Joe Sample? And then it takes me back because Joe Sample, when I was leaving high school to come up to Berklee, Joe Sample was coming back home from LA to live in Houston. He bought his home back in Houston, and they had a party for him. And me and Walter Smith and Mark Kelly and Richard Cruz, a great pianist, we were playing at the homecoming party. And they said, go sit in with the kids. And he sat in with us. And this is where I tell people all the time, you never know who's listening to you and how much, you know. So we're just kids in the corner, you know, people are in the party having fun. Joe comes and sits in with us, plays, and everybody's like, oh, okay, cool. And we were so gracious, you know, he was so gracious to play with us. And that was it, man. And here it is 5 years later, after my time is done at Berklee, and he calls and he said, you know, he asked Walter Smith III, his father, Walter Smith Jr., who was that drummer from that party? And he said, you know, he told him who I was and everything. And he called me 5 years later from playing at a party on the side in the corner somewhere. So anyway, I went and auditioned for the Crusaders and I got the gig. And then when I was in my cap and gown, Terrence Blanchard called me for the second time and said, because the first time I said, I can't do it because I was still in school. Second time he said, you want to do it? And I said, wow. And so I said, yes, in my cap and gown. So I had Terrence Blanchard's gig and I had the Crusaders gig concurrently for about 3 years. And then I stayed with Terrence for 11 years and all those things have happened and they spurred out of, you know, my relationships and I guess my talent, you know, it's been a blessing. that God placed me in those places.
Definitely a blessing for sure. But you weren't too timid or too afraid to get out there and play, which I think, you know, that's the only way that people can see what you can do. Now, if we fast forward from your origin to now, I see that you're also the founder of World Culture Music. And I wanted to give you a little bit of time to be able to talk about the purpose of that and having your own thing.
Well, World Culture Music was how I began my recording life. Terrence Blanchard was really encouraging me to record some music. And, you know, at the time, I really wasn't trying to record any music. I was just happy playing and being a sideman. He said, you need to record the music, you know. And of course, at that time, I wasn't trying to get signed or anything. So I just recorded the music myself. You know, I took my own money, recorded the music, and put it out under my own label. And then what I saw is a few of my friends were doing that. And I was like, you know what? We should just have everybody under this label. And then that's what we did. We all just started contributing and putting it under that label. But in all honesty, it started to get to be a lot for me as I was trying to just play, just get to play and just to make music. And so I ended up, you know, I still keep World Culture Music on the, it's still here. It's a little bit on the back burner because now I've been blessed to be with Blue Note. So that's been a huge blessing for me. Now I don't have to worry about all of those type of things, at least coming from me, you know, creating all of these pathways to get the music out. You know, Blue Note, being with Blue Note is a huge blessing because they have their established networks, established brand, of course, and, you know, World Culture Music is still there, but I'm happy to be with Blue Note.
Of course. I think almost anyone in the jazz idiom would be. It's the creme de la creme of jazz music labels. And so what's next for you musically? Where do you think you'll go from here?
Well, right now I'm working on a few things. My next record is going to be called Corridors, and I'm just working on that. You know, that is the next thing I'm doing. Also, I'm joining the SF Jazz Collective. That was supposed to be this year, but of course, COVID hit. So that's that changed up everything. And, you know, so I have a few projects that I'm working on at the moment. I'm also working on a project called Unearthed, which is about the Sugarland 95 down in Houston. There were 95 graves that were unearthed recently, and they were graves of slaves that were convict leased. So that's a story that I want to make sure the world is talking about. And because that is a huge find, and hopefully they will be memorialized. They're still in the process of memorializing these people down there. And crazy enough, that is right in the close to the neighborhood where I grew up in Houston. So, you know, just to think that they were a convict leasing right there, you know. So I want to write some music about that, do a piece about that. So those are the things that are pretty much right here, right now.
Well, that sounds great. I mean, that's definitely always looking forward to another album. And I think that's a really poignant thing to talk about and shine a light on, especially being from your hometown. So we always have two rapid fire questions that we ask all the guests as we conclude today. And so the first of two, what advice would you give a newbie starting out in music?
I would say that you got to realize that knowledge is the paintbrush and wisdom is how you use that paintbrush. You know, so get as much knowledge as you can, but realize you can't just rely on just that, you know. At some point, you're going to have to use that knowledge. And that's the scary part, right? Speaking of painting, you know, there are so many forgers out here. You could come and forge and make a great, you know, Renoir. You make the same Renoir painting and people be like, whoa, that's pretty cool. But the real courageous thing is to make your own painting and have people look at it side eye. And some people love it and some people hate it. That takes courage. You know what I mean? So as you're gaining the knowledge of what the greats have done, gain that knowledge and then start using it. You know, you can't pour from an empty cup. So keep filling that cup up with knowledge from different places. And I feel that creativity comes from when you take two things and put them together that nobody else would think of. You know, I don't think creativity comes straight out of the air. It comes from, you know, this convergence of different things that you've seen and done in your life. So that's what I always, you know, try to convey.
Yeah, that's amazing. I love the art analogy with the paintbrush. I think it's Picasso that says, it's not about what you see, it's about what you can make other people see through your art. So I think that's an amazing way to think about knowledge. You really do have to eventually apply it to make it useful. So then what do you want your musical legacy to be when all is said and done? And I know you have many, many more years ahead of you, but when it's all said and done, if you could remember for one thing, what would that be?
For one thing, wow. That it wasn't about music. That's all it is. If I want to be remembered, I guess I would want to be remembered as an artist who didn't make music for music's sake. He made music for life's sake, you know, to encapsulate what it meant to be living in this time. And I think when you, hopefully, my hope is that I'll create music that will be timeless, that would encapsulate this time that we're living in, hopefully bring people to think about things and change perspectives and bring about lasting change to things that are, to different social issues, to all types of issues that need to be talked about in the vein of life and not just music.
Excellent. I think that's a very interesting point. It's not about the music, but it is about the music in other ways, but it's about being. And definitely, I think music is part of the culture and part of the idiom in a way where it transcends the culture and it really helps people to heal and to come together. And I think all of that is a beautiful thing. So I just wanted to say thank you again for coming on the podcast today. And I enjoyed so much learning more about you. And whenever I see people from Berkeley doing well, I always swell up with pride. And so every time I see you across the screen or hear your music, I'm always super excited. We just wanted to say thank you again. And we will circle back to you when all of the links are out so that everybody will be able to hear it. We'll post it on our socials. And, you know, if you stay safe over there in the East Coast, we'll keep championing you and other great music on the West Coast. And, you know, hopefully when you're touring again, maybe we'll come out and see you.
All right. Well, I appreciate you.
I appreciate you too, brother. You take care. Have a good day.
All right, too.
Bye-bye. Thanks again for listening to Deeper Grooves, Musicians on Music, hosted by Cliff Beach and sponsored by California Soul Music Record Label. I had so much fun catching up with good buddy Kendrick Scott, based on the East Coast, about his new album, A Wall Becomes a Bridge, out now on Blue Note Records. He's played with so many people, great giants of jazz, and part of the Blue Note family, so definitely go check out and stream his record now. I'd like to thank our engineer, Tim Hall, for mixing and mastering this recording today as well. If you like what you hear and you want to hear more, you can check us out online at www.californiasoulmusic.com/deepergrooves or anchor.fm/deepergrooves. Until then, take care. We'll talk to you soon.